Tomorrow's high, 87.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, Medical Director and Physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. Without an understanding of how life is created, it's really hard to understand how the human body, or for that matter, any living organism's body works. So the question of how life on Earth first emerged, a question that humans have been asking themselves since time immemorial, is apropos for a medical show. Many scientists are now in agreement as to when it occurred, but there is simply no consensus, at least as of yet, on why it did.
By simple definition, amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins, are organic compounds. This means that they contain at least one atom of carbon covalently linked to atoms of other elements, most commonly hydrogen, oxygen, or nitrogen.
That's it. Carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen. If you're stumped by Carmen's use of the phrase covalently bonded, it simply means that the carbon links to any other carbons and the other components consists of sharing of electron pairs between the atoms. But that's not important for today's topic. There are about 500 naturally occurring amino acids. However, only 20 appear in the genetic code. As we said, amino acids are organic compounds that combine to form proteins. And amino acids and proteins are the building blocks of life.
What are the proteins, Grandpa?
Carmen's going to tell us now, Ronan.
When proteins are digested or broken down, amino acids are left. Then the human body uses these amino acids to make proteins to help the body. They help break down food, repair body tissue, help us grow, and perform many other body functions.
The amino acids can also be used as a source of energy by the body.
These amino acids are classified into three groups called the essential amino acids. The non-essential amino acids are finally another group called the conditional amino acids.
The term essential amino acids simply means that these particular amino acids cannot be made by the body itself and must come from the food that we eat. There are just 9 essential amino acids. The other 11 amino acids that our bodies need can be synthesized in our own bodies. Now, these essential amino acids are histidine, isoleucine, leucine, lysine, methionine, phenylalanine, threonine, tryptophan, and valine. The 11 non-essential amino acids include alanine, arginine, aspargine, aspartic acid, cysteine, glutamic acid, glutamine, glycine, proline, serine, and tyrosine.
Conditional amino acids, which are usually not essential except in times of illness and stress, include arginine, cysteine, glutamine, tyrosine, glycine, ornithine, proline, and serine.
But don't think that each and every meal must contain essential and non-essential amino acids at every meal. But getting a balance of them over the whole day is important.
So remember that a diet based on a single plant item will not be adequate. But we no longer worry about pairing proteins such as beans with rice and a single meal. Instead, we look at the adequacy of the diet overall throughout the day.
This is very important since we have spoken to many patients looking to increase their fruits and vegetables in their diet, but were concerned about how difficult it would be. So now getting back to the new research and discoveries concerning amino acids.
How the amino acids, the chemical building blocks of life, come together roughly 4 billion years ago to create the first protein molecule.
A team of researchers from the Georgia Institute of Technology Center for Chemical Evolution recently conducted a study
that showed how some of the earliest predecessors of the protein molecule may have spontaneously linked up to form a chain. How did they study this? That's pretty interesting. It was supported by NASA as well as the National Science Foundation.
The problem has always been in the path of learning how chemistry led to complex life is one that has been bandied about for years and years. For their study, the research team conducted an experiment where a small selection of amino acids, just lysine, arginine, and histidine, were placed together with three non-biological competitors' amino acids.
The acids were then subjected to conditions similar to what is believed to have existed on Earth around 4 billion years ago. They put three amino acids in water containing hydroxy acids, which are known to science to facilitate amino acid reactions and would have been common on prebiotic Earth. The mixture was then heated to 185 degrees Fahrenheit, which sped up the reaction process and caused the water to evaporate. Then they looked at the resulting chemical reactions that were studied. What they saw really surprised them. The three biological amino acids spontaneously formed into neat segments that linked together via alpha amine groups, meaning groups that are made up of nitrogen, hydrogen, and are quite reactive.
What surprised them was that this chemistry favored the alpha amino connection found in protein, even though chemical principles should have led them to believe that the non-protein connection would be favored.
Amazingly, this preference for the protein-like linkage over non-protein was about 7-1. Another surprise was the fact that the biological amino acids beat out the non-biological ones in terms of reactivity.
The latter acids, which are now found in proteins today, had the potential to chemically react just as well or maybe even better than the biological one. But that did not happen. The team actually anticipated that the inclusion of these acids would give the biological ones a run for their money and might even lead to the creation of new proteins.
But that simply didn't happen. However, the reactions resulted mostly in the formation of peptides. That is, two or more amino acids, building blocks linked together that were closer to today's actual proteins. In particular, the researchers thought that the non-biological amino acids would outcompete the biological amino acids known as lysine, and that lysine would not be able to form chains reliably.
In both cases, they were wrong, and instead found that the lysine predominantly went into the chains in a way that is similar to what happens with proteins today. So, the researchers came to the conclusion that the prefabricated amino acid chains that are useful in living systems evolved even before life had found a way to make proteins.
So, in a nutshell, the fact that their experiments showed that biological amino acids are preferred over non-biological ones may also offer new insight into why just 20 amino acids went into the formation of life. Scientists now believe that there were over 500 naturally occurring acids present on Earth during the Hadean Eon. That's 4 billion years ago. Now it appears today's biology may reflect these early prebiotic chemical reactions more than we had thought.
That period of formation, there would have been a much larger set of amino acids. The experiment suggested that the kinds of amino acids used in proteins are more likely to link up together because they simply react together more efficiently and have few inefficient side reactions.
One of the earlier theories stated that the first proteins occurred on rain-swept dirt flats or sun-baked lakeshore rocks. This theory is at odds with the theory that building blocks of life rely on rare and cataclysmic events as well as multiple ingredients in order to emerge. By showing that it was likely to be a much more straightforward process, this research that we're talking about could bring us one step further to unlocking this age-old mystery. And remember that this could also have implications in the search for life beyond Earth. If the building blocks of life are naturally reactive and attracted to one another, then it likely increases the odds that similar chemical reactions took place elsewhere in the universe.
And speaking of protein, scientists at the Institute for Research in Biome and the Molecular Biology, and speaking of proteins, scientists at the Institute for Research in Biome and the Molecular Biology Institute of Barcelona, Spain, have published a study revealing the structure of a key protein known as a portal in Epstein-Barr virus infection.
You may have heard the term Epstein-Barr virus, but maybe you haven't. Anyway, the Epstein-Barr virus, which belongs to the herpes virus family, is one of the most widespread human viruses. It's the main cause of infectious mononucleosis.
Not only that, it causes several kinds of cancer, including Burkitt and Hodgkin's lymphoma, stomach cancer, and nasopharyngeal cancer, as well as several autoimmune diseases. Right now, there is no treatment for infections caused by this particular virus.
To help find a cure, it's necessary for researchers to understand the structure of the portal protein. This could prove useful for the design of inhibitors for the treatment of herpes virus infections, such as Epstein-Barr. It's interesting and important to know that because this protein is found only in herpes viruses, these inhibitors would be virus-specific and may be less toxic for humans. So the hunt is on. All herpes viruses have a similar infection mechanism.
Once the herpes virus enters a cell and reaches the nucleus, the virus releases their DNA, which can remain latent for years until certain conditions trigger its replication. Then the DNA is introduced into a new viral capsid, thereby forming new viruses that can attack other cells. The portal protein is the route through which DNA enters the viral capsid and through which it leaves to infect cells.
This protein is called bacteriophage T7. This phage is a virus that infects only bacteria. Its DNA packaging system resembles that used by herpes virus. If researchers can understand the structure of the portal protein of this bacteriophage, T7, then they'll have been able to infer how the portal works from Epstein-Barr virus.
In both viruses, the portal protein comprises 12 subunit forming a large mushroom-shaped structure with a central channel through which DNA passes.
Think about that. Since this channel has a valve that regulates the entry and exit of the virus's genetic material, it may eventually help researchers finally find the cure or treatment or even a vaccine for the herpes virus.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 29 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care. Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show.
A common cold, booyah, and whooping cough and cooyah. Father, not a law to make you itch.
Light touch plays a critical role in everyday tasks. For example, it's important picking up a glass or playing a musical instrument. The sensation of light touch is also an essential part of the body's protective defense system.
It can alert us to objects in our environment that could cause us to fall or injure ourselves.
It can help us to protect ourselves, such as protection from the bite of certain insects, such as those that cause malaria and Lyme disease. It can do this by eliciting a feeling of an itch when an insect lands on your skin.
Salk Institute researchers have studied which has led to a better understanding of itching and hopefully could lead to new drugs to treat chronic itch, which occurs in such conditions as eczema, diabetes, and even some cancers.
A particularly famous person with chronic itch was the Frenchman Jean-Paul Marat. He was a journalist and a politician during the French Revolution, who was a vigorous defender of freedom and seen as a radical voice. Unfortunately, Marat was assassinated by Charlotte Corday while taking a medicinal bath for his debilitating skin condition that caused chronic itching. The mechanical itch sensation is distinct from other forms of touch, and it has this specialized pathway within the spinal cord itself. There's a set of inhibitory neurons or nerves in the spinal cord that acts like cellular brakes, keeping the mechanical itch pathway in the spinal cord turned off most of the time.
There are these neurons which produce the neurotransmitter, neuropeptide, YONPY for short. The mechanical itch pathway is constantly on, causing chronic itch.
What the researchers didn't know was how the itch signal, which under normal circumstances is suppressed by the NPY neurons, is transmitted to the brain to register the itch sensation.
David Acton, a postdoctoral fellow in the Golding Lab, had the idea that when the NPY inhibitory neurons are missing, neurons in the spinal cord that normally transmit light thought begin to act like an accelerator stuck in the on position.
The researchers then identified a group of excitatory neurons in the spinal cord that express the receptor for NPY. These are called the Y1 spinal neurons. But somebody needed to prove this.
Well, someone's got to do it.
And someone did.
To test whether these neurons were indeed acting like an accelerator, the main researcher undertook an experiment that involved selectively getting rid of both the NPY brake and Y1 accelerator neurons.
Remember we said that without Y1 neurons, mice didn't scratch, even in response to light touch stimuli that normally make them scratch.
So when that researcher Acton gave the animals drugs that activated the Y1 neurons, the mice scratched spontaneously even in the absence of any touch stimuli.
Thus, the researchers were able to show that the NPY neurotransmitter controls the level of Y1 nerve or neuron excitability. In other words, NPY signaling acts as a kind of thermostat to control the sensitivity to light touch.
Other data disclosed that some people with psoriasis have lower than average levels of NPY. This may mean their brakes on mechanical itching are less effective than other people.
That's why they itch.
The full pathway, well, it's still undetermined, but this is a start.
Understanding this will help suggest targets for drugs to turn down the sensation of itch in people who are overly responsive and could lead to ways to address chronic itch.
In late 2018, the Cleveland Clinic unveiled its list of the top 10 medical innovations for 2019. And we're presenting these really in no particular order. Two of these we'll leave for last only because we've recently discussed them on our radio shows. So the first we'll consider the expanded window for acute stroke intervention. When it comes to stroke intervention, a timely response is critical. Prolonged lack of blood flow following a stroke can cause irreversible destruction, often resulting in disability and even death. In many cases of stroke, intervention methods can be deployed to save tissue, but until now, intervention of a stroke had only been recommended within a very limited window of time.
New guidelines suggest an expanded window for treatment with the lengthened time frame expected to lower the risk of disability and provide opportunity for recovery to an increased number of future stroke patients.
Another exciting development was the advance in immunotherapy for cancer treatment. Cancer immunotherapy, also called biological therapy, is a technique that uses the body's own immune system to fight cancer. Scientists are creating life-changing new cancer treatments through the concept of joint therapy and engineered T cells. With the near daily discovery of new immunotherapeutic targets and biomarkers, it's helpful, once new and effective therapies will come to light for all tumor profiles.
How about the use of 3D printing? It's fun to make 3D sculptures of Darth Vader, but patient-specific products achieved with 3D printing can be amazingly useful in the healthcare industry.
I remember a recent story about a boy that lost one of his hands and found that the prosthesis cost was just out of his range. Well, some very well-meaning individual heard about him and created a 3D hand that the boy actually found useful for a very small price compared to the one that was simply out of his financial range. Now, medical devices can be matched to the exact specifications of an individual patient. 3D created devices can be designed to be more compatible with an individual's natural anatomy. And devices modeled from patient-specific dimensions have shown greater acceptance by the body, as well as increased comfort and improved performance outcomes.
Currently, the most significant work in this space includes external prosthetics, cranial orthopedic implants, and customized airway stents for diseases narrowing the airway.
Technology has also been found helpful in surgical planning. To date, the technology has been used in many complicated heart surgeries and even in the Cleveland Clinic's most recent total face transplant. With its widening healthcare applications, 3D printing is increasing the attention to detail in patient care.
We talk in detail about virtual and mixed reality and the involvement of computer technology to create simulated and hybrid environments.
Remember what we said a few weeks ago concerning VR technology? It can be much more than just a game. The programs now provide stimulating simulation training that serves to enhance traditional medical schooling. And it can be used even in treatment for such diseases as PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder.
With this immersive style of learning, VR, MR training appeals to all types of learners. Audiovisual and kinesthetic education via stimulation is a productive step towards the system's most adept and confident healthcare provider.
Though less common than ischemic strokes, hemorrhagic strokes are responsible for nearly 40% of stroke deaths. These are the strokes during which blood escapes from a ruptured blood vessel in the brain occurs.
Rapid diagnosis is absolutely necessary for effective treatment, as uncontrolled bleeding can lead to swelling of, as well as damage to, the brain. Just a few moments ago, you heard a voice you may not have recognized. Well, that's the voice of Deirdre Lasky, the mother of Ronan, who also spoke on this program.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. These now include amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, cancer, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, glaucoma, HIV/AIDS, seizure disorders, chronic muscle spasms, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, PTSD, a terminal condition, as well as other ailments and conditions, including certain diseases with chronic or long-term pain. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We've also set up a website for our Medical Marijuana Society at www.medmarsoc.com. That's www.medmarsoc.com. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. You can also set up an appointment for an office visit to Southside Medical Center right on the website. Again, that website is CompassionateCareJax.com. Well, we've come to the end of another Hey Doc show. Carmen and I hope that you've enjoyed the past half hour and have found it interesting, educational, and maybe just a little bit entertaining.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.